Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Religious Liberties Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, December 16, 2014, during a live Courthouse Steps telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call. Today, we're discussing the Little Sisters of the Poor case. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Our expert for today is Professor Mark L. Rienzi. He is at the Columbus School of Law at the Catholic University of America, and he's also senior counsel at the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty and consequently is involved in this case. So he's going to begin by giving us opening remarks of 15 to 20 minutes. After that, we're going to turn to the audience for questions, but because he is involved in the case, he might be somewhat limited in some of the questions he can answer. So with that brief caution, let's turn now to Professor Rienzi for those opening remarks. The floor is yours.
Great. Thank you, Dean. Why don't I start with some of the backstory just to get everybody up to speed on where the Little Sisters have been in this case and what the stage was for the argument at the Tenth Circuit last week. So as many of you probably recall, the Little Sisters made news on New Year's Eve of last year, getting an emergency injunction issued first by Justice Sotomayor on New Year's Eve and then a few weeks later by the rest of the court. At that point in the November-December 2013 timeframe, the nonprofit cases were just starting to get decided. Essentially, the first big wave of nonprofit cases were religious ministries that had planned years starting on January 1st, 2014, at which point the mandate would take effect if they hadn't gotten injunctions. As of about 6 o'clock on New Year's Eve, the only two plaintiffs in the country to have been denied relief were Notre Dame and the Little Sisters of the Poor. The Little Sisters of the Poor filed for emergency relief at the Supreme Court and received it at 9:30 or 10 o'clock on New Year's Eve from Justice Sotomayor, which was terrific news. At the time, Justice Sotomayor said this is essentially a short-term injunction, at least long enough to let the government file a brief opposing our petition. Which they did on, I think, January 3rd, and we responded on the same day. At that point, the government's argument in the case was that it needed to force the Little Sisters of the Poor to sign a particular form called Form 700. And the government said it needed to make them do that because it needed some regularized, orderly way to know who was objecting to participating in this mandate. So the government told the Supreme Court that the reason for the form is we need some way for them to raise their hand. Our view has always been that the system is much more complicated than that. It is not simply a raise of the hand, that what the government wants the Little Sisters to do is sign a form that has legal effects that they don't want to trigger. Namely, it designates, authorizes, and obligates other people to give out the drugs. And so the government's argument to the Supreme Court was, no, the form is just a method of raising your hand so we know who's taking the accommodation here, and we can make everything happen anyway, and so you should sign the form because it doesn't matter. A few weeks later, the entire court, or at least the court without dissent, I should say, the court issued an injunction without dissent around January 24th, and in that injunction, the court said, essentially, if the government needs a way for the Little Sisters to identify themselves, we can provide that. And so they issued an injunction that said that the Little Sisters can notify the government. They can notify the Secretary of HHS, who's then Secretary Sebelius. You can notify Secretary Sebelius of your objection, but you can do it without using the government's special form. And so the Little Sisters were very happy with that injunction. They went right ahead and notified the government that, in fact, they have that religious objection. I suspect the government already knew that, but we did it anyway, and we complied with that injunction. And so that injunction still remains in place today because the Little Sisters complied with what the Supreme Court told them to do, which is, again, simply go tell the government that you object, and then, you know, if the government wants to go work around you, let them work around you. And so the Sisters did that. After that stage, the Little Sisters case then returned to the Tenth Circuit for briefing on the appeal. The Little Sisters had been denied an injunction in the trial court. The trial judge had said, well, since your plan is a church plan, the government doesn't have the ability to force your third-party administrators to give out the drugs when you sign the form. Therefore, you should just go ahead and sign the form, sister. That was the trial court's reasoning. And the nun's reasoning was twofold. One, it was, well, whether or not the government can currently make that system work, I still can't sign permission slips for contraceptives, abortion-inducing drugs and devices, and sterilizations. And that the Little Sisters objected to the notion that they should be willing to sign for those things and then just put their faith in the fact that either A, the government's not going to come up with a way to use the form, it seems so eager to get them to sign, or B, that they would have to outsource their faith and just rely on the fact that they expect the Christian Brothers to stand firm and not give out the drugs. The Little Sisters objected to those things. They also objected that the government's definition of third-party administrator is something that they actually hadn't spelled out. And so it wasn't clear, and I'd say still isn't exactly clear, whether Christian Brothers, the church plan itself, or the group of Christian Brothers who administer it, whether they are the only third-party administrator, or whether other companies that also work doing things like, for example, processing pharmaceutical claims are also third-party administrators. So the parties briefed that back in February, March, and April. And, of course, at that same time, parties were briefing Hobby Lobby at the Supreme Court. And as I assume most of you know, at the end of June, there's a flurry of activity on this issue. June 30th, the Supreme Court decides Hobby Lobby. It says that there is, in fact, a substantial burden on the religious believer when the government threatens to crush him with fines for keeping the insurance the way they wanted to keep the insurance. And the court said that it didn't pass a strict scrutiny. The court pointed out there were a few reasons for that. They were willing to assume that the government might have a compelling interest, although they didn't find that. They just assumed it. But they said that the forcing Hobby Lobby to provide the stuff directly didn't qualify as the least restrictive means. And they really gave two arguments for that. The first was that the government had failed to carry its burden of showing that it couldn't just pay for the stuff directly. The court referred to that as the most straightforward way of getting people the drugs, is just to get people the drugs directly without forcing the religious objectors to be part of it. But the court also went on to say, and hey, you've got this accommodation that you, the government, say works awesomely, that you're offering to all these religious nonprofits. And according to your own statements, government, that alternative is every bit as good at getting people the drugs as forcing the employer to provide it. So, government, you need to offer the same deal to everybody else. That led to more briefing and more rounds of argument right after Hobby Lobby for Wheaton College. So the position that Little Sisters were in going into New Year's Eve last year is where Wheaton College was on June 30th, which is they had a plan year that was going to start on July 1st. Everybody else in the country who needed relief and protection from the mandate had gotten it. Wheaton College, unfortunately, was coming through the Seventh Circuit, where Judge Posner's Notre Dame opinion stood in their way. And although other circuit courts gave emergency relief in the wake of Hobby Lobby, the Seventh Circuit did not. They simply said that the opinion in Notre Dame controlled. Therefore, Wheaton College would have to sign the form and comply with the mandate by midnight. That led to another emergency motion, similar to the Little Sisters motion. And on July 3rd, the court, over the dissent of three justices, granted Wheaton College relief and said Wheaton College could do what the Little Sisters did, and you notify the government. And the government, you can always work around people if you want to work around people, but you can't make them sign the forms you want to make them sign. After that, the government said it was going to amend its rule in light of Hobby Lobby and in light of Wheaton College. And so they came up with a new rule that said, okay, now you don't have to sign our special form 700. Instead, you can just write us a letter saying you object, and we will treat that letter as the equivalent of form 700. So the government says, we've given you a new way to object. Your new way of objecting will have all the same effects of the old way of objecting. It will change your plan. It will give us authority to make someone an administrator on your plan and so forth. But go ahead and do that, and then we'll be fine. And so that was a rule change that came out in August. All of those changes, I'd say, took a little bit of time for the courts of appeal to think about and digest, such that there were no appellate arguments on this, to my knowledge, between, I think this is true, there were no appellate arguments on this between Hobby Lobby and Wheaton College and sometime in mid-November. And so in mid-November of this year is when we start to get the Courts of Appeal hearing arguments for the first time after Hobby Lobby, after Wheaton College, after the new rule. And there were stretch of arguments in the 3rd, 7th, 8th, and 10th circuits over the span of a few weeks from mid-November to just last week. And in each of those places, you had various courts of appeal hearing the arguments about the government's proposed accommodation and whether the government can pass RFRA scrutiny. So that's the lead up for Little Sisters of the Poor. So their case was heard by the 10th Circuit 8 days ago on Monday, December 8th. Little Sisters' case was one of three cases heard by the court that day. They heard argument in Little Sisters first. Right after that, they heard argument in the Southern Nazarene case, which is being handled by Alliance Defending Freedom and Greg Baylor. Incidentally, Greg Baylor should be knighted for his work on this, on that stretch of appellate arguments in the 3rd, 7th, 8th, and 10th circuits over a 3.5-week period. Baylor argued in every one of them. So he had a couple places where he had arguments 24, 48 hours apart, but the guy was running circuit to circuit, arguing this case on behalf of a lot of different religious ministries. So Little Sister's case was first. Baylor had the Southern Nazarene case second, and then another Beckett Fund case that we're handling, Reaching Souls International, which is another church plan case. It's the Guidestone Southern Baptist Convention church plan case, was third. So we had what turned out to be a very nice setup, very favorable setup, I would say, in that there were three arguments stacked back to back, which meant the judges had a lot of time to ask a lot of questions, and they were it was an engaged and prepared panel asking lots of good questions, and the government had to spend about an hour on its feet answering questions about its system and why they ought to win. We also had a nice setup in that we got to go first and last because we had lost in Little Sisters, so I got to open the day. And then at the end, I essentially got the last 20 minutes for the Reaching Souls case. So it was a good setup for trying to explain some complicated things to the court. And again, it was a very well-prepared and active court, so that was great. Let me just hit a few of the big points from the oral argument, and then I'm happy to take questions from folks. Right out of the gate, it was obvious that the court in the Little Sisters case was interested to know what exactly would happen if the Little Sisters did what they're saying they can't do, which is either sign the form or provide the notice to the secretary. Little Sisters had said, look, my religion tells me I can't do those things because they are part of the government's system to deliver these drugs, and they authorize you essentially to take over my plan to either compel or, at the very least, offer lots of money to people to give out these drugs in conjunction with my plan. I don't want to authorize that. So the court wanted to know, well, as a practical matter, what's going to happen if you sign the form or send in the notification? Government actually came right out and answered that question and said, well, what's going to happen is we're going to send notices to the people who do work on the plan, not just Christian Brothers, but also Express Scripts Incorporated, which is a big public company that is giving out these drugs in connection with other people's plans. We're going to send them a letter, and we're going to offer to them that if they will give out the drugs in conjunction with your plan, essentially using your plan information, giving it to beneficiaries only so long as they're on the plan and so forth, we'll pay them their costs, and we'll also offer to pay them a 15% bonus for their margin and overhead. It probably will not surprise you to hear that Catholic nuns can't be the ones to, the Little Sisters of the Poor do not feel like they can sign forms and send in notifications that essentially authorize their third-party administrator to do those things. The Little Sisters' view is that they deliberately signed up for a plan that didn't come with access to these drugs, and they can't take steps to create that access on the plan. There was a good bit of discussion over whether what the government was asking the Little Sisters to do was just the equivalent of raising your hand, just the equivalent of saying, I object, or I'm a conscientious objector. I think it's really clear that that's not so for a couple of reasons. One is that if all the government needed was the little sisters to raise their hand, that's already happened a couple times over. In other words, it happened when they filed the lawsuit. The government knows they object. It also happened in January with the Supreme Court's injunction that said, just tell the government you object. And the little sisters did that. So it's obvious that it's not just about raising your hand, but it's about the government trying to turn the hand raising into something that automatically triggers changes to your own plan and authorizations to people to do things on your plan that you don't want to do. To put it another way, one of the big questions that I don't think the government ever satisfactorily answered is, if it's just about raising your hand, why is the government still fighting the nuns? In other words, the government's position was always a little bit odd. The form doesn't matter, but I'm going to fight the little sisters of the poor to the Supreme Court to make damn sure they sign it. That was always a really weird position for the government to take. They continued to take that weird position in court, both saying, I don't think much that's all that important is going to happen if they sign the form, but we've got a compelling interest in making it happen to get people the drugs. And so I think it was very clear the government was after something. It's not just about raising your hand. If it was raising your hand, that already happened a long time ago. The government wants more, and they want more because they've set up a system that is designed to piggyback on the employer's plan. That's why they try to run it through ERISA. That's why they use the Department of Labor. They are trying to piggyback off the employer's plan, and they need to make the employer do some stuff to make that happen. And essentially, the little sister said, I can't do that for you. You've got to go provide it some other way. It was also clear in the argument that it was clear in the briefs that the government had simply failed or refused to address 10th Circuit precedent on how the substantial burden analysis goes. And the judges called them on it and were quite open about the fact that they noticed there was no discussion of the 10th Circuit's standards on these things at all. They also pointed out that there had been no discussion of the leading case in the 10th Circuit on religious discrimination. And this is an issue that came up, I would say, more in the 10th Circuit than in the other circuit courts. One of the things that's particularly strange about the government's rule here is, if the Little Sisters of the Poor would just take the keys to their homes and walk down the block and hand them to the bishops and say, bishops, you go ahead and control and fund my homes for the elderly poor. The government at that point would look at the exact same home with the exact same employees, the exact same elderly poor people, and say, okay, that counts as an integrated auxiliary and it's completely exempt from the mandate. No form, no notification. You don't have to do anything. You're just completely exempt. And the government did not have a particularly good answer for why it was that they should be allowed to discriminate among religious ministries that way. In other words, it's not at all clear that there's any valid reason for the government to look at a home for the elderly poor run by nuns and a home for the elderly poor run by bishops and say, the one run by bishops, that's exempt. We don't need to provide anything. We don't need any control over that. That's fine. But the one run by the nuns has to do what the nuns view as violate their religion. So the court focused on that. They focused particularly on a 10th Circuit decision called Larson v. Weaver, written by then-Judge Michael McConnell, who is a, among other things, a big religious liberty expert. And that was a nice development. After the Little Sisters case, again, the Southern Nazarene case was argued, and that's a case that involves several colleges and has all different types of plans, the self-insured, the third-party insured, and a church plan. And again, after that, and Greg Baylor from Alliance Defending Freedom did an excellent job with that case. And then after that, we got to close the arguments by talking about the Reaching Souls Guidestone case. And one of the things the Guidestone case is really nice for is it shows, it essentially disproves the conclusions of Judge Posner in the Seventh Circuit and Judge Pillard in the D.C. Circuit, where they said that, oh, it's independent obligations of law that make these drugs flow. Well, the fact of the matter is it's not independent obligations of law, and there's a very easy way to know that. The easy way to know that is if you look at every case in which an injunction has been entered, in every case in which the religious ministry doesn't have to sign the form, guess what happens? No drugs. The drugs don't flow. The government can't make them flow because the government can only hijack the plan of the religious ministry if the religious ministry goes along with it. And so the Reaching Souls case was a nice just sort of a nice real life proof in the pudding case to end with, because there you had a third-party administrator who had said, if you give us this notice, we will send out letters to every woman on your plan over the age of 10. So the 10-year-old daughters of your employees would get notices from the administrator saying, we can pay for you to get IUDs and emergency contraception and so forth. And they had said they were willing to do that, and if we notified them, they would. So their plan was to go ahead and do it. We got the injunction, and voila, no letters to the 10-year-old kids of your employees. That's the proof, and that's how you know that things like the Priests for Life case and other cases that say independent obligation of law are just factually incorrect. It's just not so. If you can't hijack the employer and you can't make the employer sign the papers, the drugs don't flow. The government's tried to build a system based on the takeover of those plans. It can only execute that takeover if it can force them to act. And so that's why these religious objectors have their religious objections to helping the government act that way. And it was a good example, and it was helpful to have that case at the end to demonstrate to the judges that we're actually quite right and the government's quite wrong. In this system, they need our signatures to make things happen. It's very reasonable for us to say we don't want to do it. And I guess the last point I'd make is, and it's very unreasonable to think that the only way the United States government could get contraceptives to people is by involving the nuns. This is a government that runs exchanges. They run big programs that give people contraceptives all across the country. If there is a Little Sisters employee who does not like the insurance offered by the nuns, that employee today is perfectly free to go to the exchanges and get a policy there. And if the government thinks that the policies on its exchanges are too expensive, the government is perfectly free to subsidize. But there's simply no reason at all that the most powerful government in the world can look around and say, gosh, I don't know how I could possibly get contraceptives to people. Somebody call the nuns. It's just really a silly argument to say that the United States government needs the Little Sisters of the Poor to give out contraceptives. So ultimately, my thinking is that in the end result of all this, the government's never going to have a satisfactory answer to that question. Why can't you just do it yourself? They really should just go do it themselves. That's it for my summary. I'm happy to take questions.
Very good. Thank you very much, Professor. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for Professor Mark Rienzi, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got just one question pending, and then our lines will be open. Before we go to that first question, let me just make a quick announcement about upcoming Teleform conference calls. Tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern Time, we'll be talking about public defenders and client choice, an experimental program that's using vouchers for accused defendants that they can use to retain attorneys of their own, so they have some choice in their representation. That's tomorrow at 2 p.m. And then Friday at 2 p.m., we'll be speaking with Brett Stevens of the Wall Street Journal about his new book, America in Retreat, The New Isolationism and the Coming Global Disorder. That's Friday at 2 p.m. It's possible, I suppose, that we'll schedule a teleforum on Thursday, so do check the Federal Society's website for updates. Today, of course, we're talking to Mark Rienzi. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got just one question pending. Let's go to that first caller.
Hi, Mark. This is Matt from ADF. Great summary. I see that the 10th Circuit website has the MP3s up of your argument, which I have not listened to, but I look forward to doing that. My question sort of relates to the ERISA part of the case. Did the government ever decide whether the letter it sends to a TPA is a plan instrument or whether the letter that the Little Sisters send to the government is the plan instrument? I guess you can take that.
Yeah, so I am not aware of any place where they have clearly answered that question in court. Certainly not in the Tenth Circuit. They did not answer that question, in part because their argument for the first and the third cases, the two church plan cases, was ERISA doesn't apply here at all. But, of course, as I'm guessing you know, Matt, the draft form that they created says that a notification to the secretary is, in fact, an instrument under which the plan is operated. And I think the regs make clear that the government thinks it needs and a plan instrument to make its system work. And ultimately, I think what that all goes back to, and the fact that we're even talking about ERISA, is that no matter what the government wants to say about its extra ride-along contraceptive-only benefits that come with your religious ministry's plan, that at the end of the day, the only authority they have to make that work is to actually tag it onto the back of the plan. And that's why they need to find ways to call one of these documents a plan document, a document under which the plan is written. And I think that actually goes to one of the things that's particularly outrageous about what the government's doing, which is they're going to private parties and they're saying, okay, if you have a religious objection to putting contraceptives in your contract, fine, you don't have to. But I'm going to come in and I'm going to put them in your contract. I'm going to use your contract as the vehicle with this plan that is essentially a parasite that can have no independent existence whatsoever except as a forced adjunct to the plan. So they did not clearly answer that question. I think it's perfectly fair to say that they've answered it in their draft form, which says that your notice to the government counts as a plan instrument. And I think it's utterly reasonable that folks like the Little Sisters of the Poor and many others look at the world and say, well, gosh, I'm not allowed to execute a plan instrument that's going to have the function that you want me to create here.
Did they say whether their letter to Express Scripts would be different than a letter to an ERISA subject TPA?
They did not answer that question, but reading between the lines, I suspect their letter would be different, and their letter would say, although I can't force you, I hereby invite you, and look at my pretty suitcase full of cash. I'll pay you a lot of money if you'll just start giving out the drugs. I assume that's what they would do. I don't know that for sure, though, because they keep issuing regulations that say the third-party administrator has an obligation to give it out. So maybe they would just send a letter that matches that. They're very careful in court to say, yeah, even though it says there's an obligation, there's not really an obligation. We can't actually enforce that. And they take this position that assumes people will willfully ignore a federal law that says you must provide it. I think that's kind of far-fetched. I think most people who see something like that, most businesses certainly that have no religious objection, are going to say, well, boy, if the law says I must provide, then I guess I better must provide. But they have not specified what their letter in that context would look like.
Okay, thanks.
We've got one question pending now. If you want to join the queue, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another question now.
Yes, thank you very much again for this update. I'm curious if you've seen either in this case or somewhere else, what do you think the government's best argument would be for that crux of a question that you pointed out? You know, why doesn't the government just provide this themselves? If this were to go up and SCOTUS were to say, yep, they win on this issue, what's the best argument they have there?
I can't begin to make good arguments for them. I apologize. I will tell you what I expect them to say. I expect them to say, oh, but then somebody would have to go over to these exchanges, and these exchanges are terrible. No one really wants to go to them. Well, maybe they wouldn't be that forthright. I assume they would say, look, that might cost us money, and that would be a hassle, and it's easier if I can just steal the nun's policy. That's not an acceptable argument for least restrictive means under strict scrutiny. And the government has already said that it's willing to pay some money to do this, right? It's willing to pay the TPAs to do it. And they have said in Hobby Lobby and other cases that they think sending people to the exchanges is a perfectly good solution. So I think the truth is they have already lost that argument because they've already conceded that they don't mind sending people to the exchanges. I think that's why they're trying very, very hard to say that there's just no burden on religion, right? There's no burden at all on religion here if I force the nuns to violate their religion. So judge, don't even get to the strict scrutiny question. I think they have a very hard time explaining why this is the least restrictive means.
We did have to mute that caller's phone line because we were getting some feedback. Let me unmute that phone line now and see if there's a follow-up question. Does the caller have a follow-up question by any chance?
No, thank you very much.
All right. Once again, our lines are now wide open. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got one caller now. So let's actually, we've got three questions. So we're touching some nerves here. Let's take another call.
Hello. My question pertains to the compelling interest. And I was wondering if any work has been done to examine the Institute of Medicine study, specifically the fact that it only touches on cost sharing. It doesn't touch on seamless interest, that the idea that the contraceptions have to be provided by the same plan that the employee gets the other benefits. All the studies and the study itself only discuss the fact that they should be free of extra cost. Has anybody examined that?
So I think it has been examined. It didn't come out in the Tenth Circuit argument. I know Greg Baylor has made that argument in at least one other circuit. I forget whether it's the Third or the Seventh. But the short answer is, yeah, this claim, this seamless access claim that Judge Pillard essentially built her opinion around in Priest for Life, is one that is neither supported by the IOM report nor was advanced by the government in the trial court in these cases. In other words, the seamless argument is one they invented this fall. If you look at their briefing in Hobby Lobby and Conestoga, for example, they never assert that seamless access is what they're looking for. And I agree with you, the IOM report provides no support for this notion that there needs to be seamless access to contraceptives. The passages they point to are, as you say, one, about cost sharing. Two, they're more about mammograms than about contraceptives anyway. So there is no support in the record for that. The government didn't argue seamlessness below, especially in the Little Sisters case, although in court on Monday, they were trying to talk about seamlessness. The fact of the matter is, in all of their briefs, they never said their interest was seamless access because their whole point was they said no one would get it anyway, so sisters should just sign the form. So I agree with you. I think there's no support for that. In the Tenth Circuit, that's a dead issue because the Tenth Circuit's Hobby Lobby decision says there's no compelling interest. So I don't expect that court to have a separate compelling interest analysis. But I do think the D.C. Circuit and Priest for Life is as wrong as you could be in claiming that there's any support for a compelling interest in seamless access. I don't think they've even gotten close to that.
Got a couple more questions pending. Let's take another call now.
Yeah, this is Stephen Casey from Texas Center for Defense Life. A brief question. Given the fact that you see courts disagreeing, like you just said, on compelling interest, wouldn't it be, I think, quicker from the proponents who have a pro-life objection to contraception to just really focus preemptively on a piece of conscious legislation that's just expressly directed toward participation in contraception and abortion? And granted, we're going to fight on the court side with a RCRA type test. They're really to kind of surgically go in legislatively and get something there. And what do you think the chances are coming up in the next congressional session?
So unfortunately, I have to plead perfect ignorance on that question. I really don't know. I certainly like good statutes that protect religious liberty. I think RCRA has done a ton of good. But as for what could be improved with legislation or what the chances are of getting it passed, I guess I'm not the right person. I'm not knowledgeable enough to give you a good answer on that.
Once again, we're speaking with Professor Mark Rienzi. If you have a question, we've got just one caller in the queue right now. You can join the conversation by pushing the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, Mark. This is Teresa Collette at the University of St. Thomas. This semester, I had my students do a simulated case on the state contraceptive mandates that we know exist in New York and California, as well as adding in the abortion dimension, which both New York and California have done. Have you been following those cases, and what impact, if any, since Hobby Lobby is RCRA, which is only a federal statute, what impact of your case can we look for if we're going to have to defend people at the state level against state legislation?
So it's a great question, and I don't really know the answer to it. I don't know if Hobby Lobby's, I know the California, for example, I think in their Catholic Charities case now a decade ago, I guess, they purported to reach strict scrutiny and said that it satisfied strict scrutiny. I don't know if something like Hobby Lobby saying that it actually doesn't satisfy strict scrutiny would would be helpful there, or whether state courts would simply feel, well, that's the feds under their statute, and we've got a different system here, so we're not obligated to follow it. I guess my less optimistic side says that courts in states that want to have those kinds of rules are not going to, they're not going to be terribly moved by the Supreme Court's decision in Hobby Lobby because they're going to find ways to write it off. I think that's a terrible thing, and I think people having to face state mandates are, in need of protection. And generally speaking, I think those state mandates do at least provide a little bit more wiggle room than the federal mandates in terms of being able to self-insure or get on an ERISA plan, an ERISA self-insured plan, and step out of the mandate. But I don't know the details of that. I just know that at least some states have a little bit more wiggle room. Nothing at all that I would consider satisfactory by any stretch.
Let me make another call for questions here. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are wide open at this point. While we're waiting to see if somebody else has a question, let me ask you, Professor Rienzi, a quick question on procedure. Well, two questions, really. One, the Justice Sotomayor's action on New Year's Eve took some criticism from the commentariat, I suppose, who characterized it as a surprising move. It seemed to me more routine than surprising when there's a case of some importance and complexity for a justice to act as she did. So that's my first question is, do you agree with that? And secondly, with regard to the more recent argument, were there any surprises there?
Sure. So as to Justice Sotomayor on New Year's Eve, no, I think she did the exact right thing in her position. You've got the federal government bearing down on her religious ministry, saying that in 24 hours I need to be able to find the millions of dollars over a form that the federal government itself says doesn't matter all that much. The idea that the Supreme Court should have just stood by silently and let the hammer fall, where almost everybody else has been protected, where we have a First Amendment that's designed to protect religious institutions, and where the United States government is in court saying, yeah, this doesn't matter that much. I think that would have been a bad result and the wrong thing to do. And so I'm very happy and grateful that Justice Sotomayor saw fit to give the protection there and give the parties a chance to brief the issue. And Justice Kagan did the exact same thing on the night of June 30th for Wheaton College, even though Justice Kagan 3 days later decided against them. So I think there's something admirable about the way the court has handled those emergency petitions. I don't think the government seriously contends that if it has to wait 24 or 48 hours, the world's going to end in these cases anyway. So I think it's certainly the right thing to do for these justices to enter these orders, let people have their little bit of space to make the arguments, and then we'll see what happens from there. And, you know, I don't think it's If you look at the results so far, most of the time in these cases, the religious objectors have won. We've been to the Supreme Court three times where we've gotten decisions of any sort of substance from the court on these, and three times we've been up, and three times the government's lost, and the religious objectors have won. I think that's because the government's case in these situations is actually pretty weak. This is something the government could do without crushing these religious ministries, and they really just should go do it. And so I don't think it's a surprise when the justices act to protect people in that kind of circumstance. As for surprises at oral argument in Denver on Monday, I don't think so. I think it was pretty much as expected. It was heartening to hear the government come right out and acknowledge that in the Little Sisters case, they will send those letters to Express Scripts to make the offer. I think that helped make it very concrete for the judges on the panel why it is that Mother Provincial would say, okay, I can't sign the form that makes that happen. But on the whole, I think it was, the argument was pretty much as expected. The government said the things that they've been saying in other courts, and we made our arguments. It was nice to have the amount of time and space that everybody had to do it.
Very good. We've got yet another question. If you want to join the queue, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another question.
That's a great summary. I'm sorry I came in a little bit late, Professor, but I've got two probably really dumb questions, but I'd like to see if you could kind of stretch your mind around them. One is, what could be the effect of this case on the other case about the, established by the state and subsidies to the 36 states that's did not establish their exchange. Any kind of, I mean, I know there are different issues, but what kind of effects could there be in, from a judicial standpoint, saying, okay, we want to be consistent in yielding a good public result? That's one. The second one, the cases that we're talking about seem to all be where it's concerned with the rights of religious organizations. And I'm wondering, if this case were to come down clearly on the side of the Little Sisters of the Poor, could it be leveraged, or is there any way that the premises of that case could be extended to apply to equal or equivalent rights of individuals, not to be coerced into policies, say, offered by their employers that provide for coverages that they find immoral?
Sure. Let me start with the second question first, if I can. Sure. I think a win for the religious institutions in these cases is helpful for an employee who doesn't want to be forced. The problem, or the possible problem for the employee who doesn't want to be forced to buy into a policy someplace, is, you know, you or I goes to work for Walmart. We don't have the right, at least, you know, it's at least not obvious right out walking in off the street. If their insurance policy happens to cover something we don't like, it's not easy to see what's the violation of the law if they say, look, my insurance policy has abortions in it, and so if you want to be part of our plan, yeah, sure, some of your money's going to go to abortion. That's a harder case because it's not the government forcing you to do stuff. So I do think sort of individual employees who happen to work for employers who provide stuff they don't like, that's not a simple case to win, but I think all those cases would all be aided by the proper resolution of these nonprofit religious ministry cases. As to the interplay between the contraceptive mandate cases and the subsidy case, King v. Burwell, that the Supreme Court's going to hear, I don't know what the interplay is exactly. I think it's a little bit unclear. They're certainly not directly related. But assuming the government will lose in King v. Burwell, you know, their system would be in serious disarray and trouble if they can't go ahead and offer those subsidies they want to offer. I'm not quite sure the rest of the system works. And so theoretically, you know, could that bring the whole thing tumbling down? I think that's at least possible. I don't know enough about the economics of it to really know. But I'll say this about one parallel between the cases. In King v. Burwell, you have the IRS deciding that it would be good for the president and his policies to offer what are, I think, tens, if not hundreds of billions of dollars in subsidies to people that Congress did not authorize. If the government is willing to take that step, then they really ought to be willing to just find a way to give out contraceptives when they want to give out contraceptives. But you have this odd juxtaposition where in King v. Burwell, the IRS is asserting this really broad power to go give out billions of dollars that Congress never authorized because they think it's the right thing to do, and they think it fits, and they think it's what's sensible. Yet in the contraceptive mandate cases like Little Sisters, the government comes in and says, they say, well, no, our hands are tied. We're limited. We can only do the stuff Congress directly authorized. We don't have the freedom to just go do whatever we want. That's an odd, it's an odd two different statements for the government to be making, and I do think that you know, they look a little bit strange when in the Little Sisters case they just come in sort of, you know, with their hands coming out of their pockets saying, gosh, I just don't know how to do this. I need the nuns. When in the other case they just go ahead with tens of billions of dollars of stuff. They clearly are able to act broadly and unilaterally and without Congress when they actually want to. So the idea that they're suddenly really constrained and careful about congressional authority in the nuns case is a little bit tough to swallow.
A little hard to swallow, yeah. Thank you.
We have one question pending. Again, if you'd like to ask a question of Professor Mark Rienzi, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another call. Caller, you might have your telephone on mute. We've activated your phone, but you have to unmute yourself.
Okay. You can hear me now. Yeah,
I can hear you now, by it.
Society member here in Berkeley. I think you alluded this to in your comments. I mean, it's sort of curious the government is digging its heels in on this case. And, you know, there's so many other things in the world which need attention, but the amount of resources and focus on this is a little bit strikes me as a bit unusual. So, you know, I'd like to get your thoughts on whether there are larger overarching issues or what's behind, you know, the government's push here.
I wish I knew. I agree with you. It's very odd if you think about it of, you know, that there are cases, surely there are cases from time to time when the government really needs to force somebody to violate his or her religion. That does happen because sometimes the government's interest is really compelling enough that you have no choice but to say, tough luck, religious objector, you lose your case. This is so far from that. This is so obviously solvable by anybody who actually wanted to solve it. It's so easy for the government to work around the nuns if they were actually interested in working around the nuns, that it really does leave you scratching your head. It leaves me scratching my head. What's really going on? I don't claim any ability to read their minds. I think it's at least entirely plausible that somebody decided there's actually good politics for the base in showing sort of a take no prisoners, no surrender attitude on contraception. I think, you know, people thought that was a good move for the 2012 election, and I think they're just, I guess I would also say, I think there are some people who think, you know, the nuns ought to just sort of bow down before the altar of contraception and just do what we're telling them to do, and that they don't, there, I think there's some people who think it's not such a bad thing if we make clear that we can force you to. So I don't really know. I'm just guessing. I agree with your premise 100%. This is really weird that the government's still fighting this. There's no good, plausible, reasonable, rational answer as to why they should still do that, given the fact that they have exchanges where they could give everybody policies that they want to give policies to. It's very hard to look at this and say, oh, this is just the government fighting hard to protect its important program. And if anything, the government shows up in court saying, well, our program doesn't even work. But I want the ability to force somebody to be part of it. It's always been a weird position for them to take.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. We have another question pending, so let's go to our next caller.
Professor, if this did not involve a mandate but a prohibition, the type of prohibition similar to the one in the City of Hialeah case, would your argument have been identical?
That's too much for me to think about quickly. Could you spell it out further?
Well, here we have a mandate to the Little Sisters of the Poor to do something immoral, somewhat like cases like the Mennonites sending their children to high school or
sure.
Other cases like that. Then on the other hand, there are cases in which the government prohibits something, and even though it's generally applicable, sometimes it is unconstitutional, as in the City of Hialeah case. If this had been not a mandate but a prohibition, would your argument have been identical?
So I think, at least under Tenth Circuit precedent, the tests are the same for forcing somebody to take an affirmative action that violates her religion or prohibiting her from doing something she says her religion requires. Under Tenth Circuit law, those two legal tests are the same. They're part of the same test. Either one constitutes a substantial burden on religion, and then you move on to strict scrutiny. So I think at least under Tenth Circuit law, the answer would be those two things would be treated the same. And I think that's probably the right answer. In other words, whether you're being forced to violate your religion by affirmatively doing something you say God tells you don't do, or you're violating your religion by being precluded from doing something that God says you're supposed to do. Either way, the government's obviously putting a burden on your religion, and under RFRA, either they got a good enough reason for it or they don't.
Well, someday we may have a Mormon case on polygamy coming up, and that doesn't completely square with the identical treatment of prohibitions and mandates, does it?
I don't know. I would have to think about that one further.
Let me make another call for questions. Our lines are wide open right now. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We do have another question. Let's take another call.
Hi, this is Matt again, since there were no other questions. What was the government asked, why doesn't it send its offer to Express Scripts now? Why does it need the Little Sisters to send them a letter before they send that offer?
I forget if they were asked that directly. If they were asked it directly, they didn't give a direct answer to it. So I don't know. But I know that under the rules, the form goes out when the Little Sisters trigger it. And so the little sisters say, I can't trigger it. But I don't know why they don't just do it. I suspect it's that, you know, they don't have the ability to just take over the contract and to authorize anybody to do anything on the contract. And I wonder if they think that their offer wouldn't be terribly useful if they don't have buy-in from the religious objector, essentially authorizing the whole thing to happen. But I don't really know. Again, if they were asked it, they didn't give a clear answer to it.
We do have another question. If you want to join the queue, push the star button and then the pound button on your phone. Let's take another call.
Hello again. Would you have an argument if the if there was no requirement for the form? So if it all did operate by operation of law, and it was just this instance where an employer could never provide a plan without the law hijacking it.
Would we still have a claim? Yeah.
Yeah, and would it be based on the instead of compelling an action, preventing an action?
I suppose, although again, for the reasons I said before, I don't view those as terribly different under the law. But yeah, if the form didn't exist at all, but the government said, if you offer a health plan, I will take it over and make it give out contraceptives. I absolutely think everybody would have a claim. I think it would be every bit as good a claim. You'd be doing the analysis at a slightly different point, but the nuts and bolts of it would be the same, which is, hey, I've got a contract, and I used to be allowed to sign a contract that matched with my religion. And now what the government is doing is coming in and taking my contract and effectively adding stuff to it that I don't want added. And they're paying somebody to use my plan information and give people stuff on my contract because they're beneficiaries of my contract. That is an interference with what I'm doing, and it violates my religion to go along with that. I think those folks would absolutely have a claim, even without a form.
Thank you.
Final call for questions. If we have any further questions for Professor Mark Rienzi, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Professor, I don't see that final question. Well, here we do. We do have the final question. Let's go to our next call.
Thank you again very much. I just had one follow-up question from one of the other inquirers. I'm just curious your thoughts on a little bit more detail on the application of individuals, you know, being forced onto their employer plan. It seems like there's an issue with the you know, the private market issue there, but as far as the religious objector, I'm just curious that, you know, what would the standing be in a situation like that?
So I guess I don't know. I'd have to think in more detail about it. And I apologize. Is everybody else getting the echo?
I think everybody else was getting the echo, Professor, but I've muted the caller's phone, so I think we're good now.
Terrific. You know, I assume the standard would be, look, religiously, I can't pay into a plan that includes abortion, and my employer is making me pay into such a plan, otherwise I can't get health care. All I was saying, I have not thought in great detail about that claim. All I was saying before is I think that is in some sense a harder claim than the current claims you've got, because that claim often would not be against the government. I think the standing, the extent you need standing against the employer, it would be my employer's making me do something that God tells me I can't do. So I don't think it's a question of not having standing, but I think it's a question of what law would you say it violates for the employer to do that. It's not an easy case for me to think through all the details of. I think people have a little bit better claim if they are individuals who are being forced by the government to buy a plan on the exchanges, and all the plans in the exchanges have abortion. I think that's a claim that it's pretty easy to see how and why that has legs. The government's forcing them to take an action that they can't take. I just think it's harder if it's a private employer. And to be clear, harder, but not necessarily impossible. It may be a perfectly valid claim. I just haven't thought it through.
Let me make yet another final call for questions. Oh, we do have another question. Let's go to our next question.
I'm the one who called with that question that that got the follow-up about the individual, and I was thinking of somebody who works for any kind of government entity or government-subsidized entity or somebody that works where there's a federal money involved, and so the employer, I was just trying to think if that would make any difference as to, if not standing, at least the government has induced the employer, even in a private case, to create those health benefits so that the employer gets the tax advantage of providing the benefits through the Internal Revenue Code.
I think it's possible, but I think it would be, again, I think it would be a harder, more complicated case, and I haven't thought that one through.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Very good. Well, Professor, we've got a couple minutes left if you want to make a wrap up or express any final thought you might have here today.
No, I guess I would just end with what I said before about least restrictive means. The idea that the United States government can't come up with some other way to get people contraceptives without taking over the nuns plan is just a, you know, if it weren't so serious, it would be laughable. It would be Saturday Night Live stuff. This is the United States government, and they are a really big, powerful government. And now they run exchanges. They run websites where anybody who wants insurance can go get it. The idea that they must make the nuns yield is a weird idea. And it certainly doesn't pass the required tests of strict scrutiny. And it's not the kind of thing that anybody should be willing to accept. We have a First Amendment. We have protection for religious institutions for a reason. The government should not be able to beat them up and threaten to crush them and put them out of business over things that even the government says are not terribly important, which is what they say about their own form. So ultimately, this is a case that, from my point of view, would be great if it never had to happen, and I'll be delighted if and when we get to the final end of it, because it's the kind of thing that the government shouldn't be wasting their time on. The government should just, if they want to give out contraceptives to people, then they ought to just go give out contraceptives to people, and they ought to just let the nuns go back to taking care of the old poor people, which is what they are here to do, and that's what they want to do. And so I look forward to the time where they can just get back to that and not have their government chasing them around.
Well, Professor, let me thank you on behalf of the Federalist Society. We certainly appreciate you joining us today, and
my pleasure.
I hope I fear this litigation goes on. We might need to check back with you, if that's okay with you, and get a further update at some point in the future. To our audience, thanks for dialing in. We certainly appreciate your thoughtful questions, and a reminder that our next teleforum conference call is scheduled for tomorrow, Wednesday, December 17th at 2 p.m. Eastern Time, when we'll be discussing public defenders and client choice. But until that next teleforum conference call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.